What would you like to say, Katie, about the book, Mechanical Bride?
Well, I thought his prose in this book was different than anything that I had read by Marshall McLuhan before.
Okay, wait a minute. I just got interrupted.
Sure.
New messages. Yes, Lisa is that person. Tomato's still going strong, Bob. So good. That's Lisa in Australia. We didn't know where your coal mine was and that you're working. We wondered if you were even in China. So that's cleared up. You're not in China. And in Australia, Melody Rose is mellow while listening, Bob. Love listening. Not much else to say. Then Jay says, don't worry, it will cool down. Now, that could be James. We don't know who Jay is. Don't worry, it will cool down, says Jay. Lisa says, yeah, Bob, to whatever I was saying. She goes, yeah. So now, Katie, could you say that sentence again? What was the...
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, this is my sixth. I was just counting while you were reading the messages. This is my sixth McLuhan book.
Really?
That's amazing.
So what have you read?
Gutenberg Galaxy, Understanding Media, the Extensions of Man, The Medium is Massage, War and Peace in the Gold Village, and Complete Archetype.
That's five.
And now Mechanical
Bride. Incredible.
But nobody's ever read that many books
that fast of McLuhan land. They don't even finish Understanding Media. They conk out.
Well, I've read six, because I've also read Mechanical Bride, so it's six.
I think you read too fast. That's incredible. You can't read that fast. I mean, McLuhan's meant to be read slowly, but you're
That's just me. I think I'm parallel worlding and reading. I'm reading, and I sometimes I fall asleep a little bit when I read. I'll just doze off for a second, and then I take the books to bed with me, too. And I ask before I fall asleep. I know this sounds crazy. But, let's take this wherever I'm going with me.
All right. So what happens when you wake up and you're not conscious of having read it. Aren't you conscious reading through it all? If you do the parallel world.
Yeah, I am. I don't know what's happening, but I'm definitely reading it. And... like I said last week, I've always read this way. I've read this way since I was 8 years old, and my mom read this way. I would come home from school, and the house would just be a mess, and she would be sitting on the couch with a blanket reading.
Right.
And she would go to book clubs, and it would be Umberto Eco, and everyone would pretend that they had read it, and they hadn't, but she had. So, and my sister reads like this, and my aunt reads like this.
You're a fast reader. There's no getting around. You're a fast reader. Okay.
And it doesn't take me any time to warm up. I can sit down, open it, read a couple pages, close it. I took the book to the hairdresser today. I can sit and read 10 pages and then get up and move on to something else and go back and forth. I don't have to, sit and spin up.
Right, and you may be right. You may be slipping into other worlds and reading them faster somehow. Yeah.
Yeah.
It could be. We have to include that scenario. Well, that's very good. So what did you make of A Mechanical Bride?
Okay, so I thought the prose in this book was so beautiful, I wanted to weep in places.
Mm.
And Marshall has demonstrated that he's an English teacher in his... In his other books, in terms of being able to reference a lot of different things that great literary figures have written,
yes.
But this book really, really to me showed how beautiful his turn of phrase is.
Yeah,
this was just gorgeous to read.
This was his prose. This was
his
voice, not quoting Gutenberg Galaxy. It's hundreds of quotes from all kinds of writers.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so, not to jump ahead, but so I ordered Tar tonight because now I want to read some Wyndham Lewis. I want to read a novel now.
Now, that'll be a good test. Now, Apes of God will be
excited.
A test on your reading ability. Apes of God.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, I'll do that after Tar.
Begin with Tar. Here's the thing about Tar. Joyce is doing Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man the same time that Wyndham Lewis, were both born in 1882, both are geniuses, can do many different arts, and they're both trying to explain the creative process of a young artist. And so Wyndham Lewis does Tar, and Joyce does Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. So that's the comparison you're eventually going to make. Who did it better? Mm-hmm. Who did it? What was the difference?
Okay. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, yeah.
This is just on a little tangent. I also read a screenplay. When did I read that? On Sunday, that a friend of mine wrote, which is the first time in a long time that I've read something that wasn't McLuhan, because that's all I've been reading for the last 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And it was so simple. Like, I felt like I was reading a cereal box.
Yeah.
Now I'm spoiled.
Well, McLuhan said the same thing about his own reading. And Margaret Atwood is a famous, huge Canadian writer, novelist.
I've read Margaret Atwood.
Yes, and McLuhan said he couldn't read. What?
Oryx and Crake and The Handmaid's Tale.
Right. So McLuhan wrote back. He had a little correspondence with her, but he said to us privately that he couldn't read her books. He implied they were too simple. I mean, he's someone who's dealing with spinning his wake all the time. But, yes, he found most novels. You'll find in Mechanical Bride in the section called The Book of the Hours, where he talks about the novels being made at that time in the 40s, and he says they're ridiculous. He's not impressed with any novels that are happening because he knows Ulysses, a very complex book back then, was the ultimate novel. So once you're into Ulysses, you're going to find what you just said. It's the cereal box stuff.
Sure, and then he picks that theme up again in the section about Reader's Digest.
Yes, yeah, Pollyanna Digest.
Mm-hmm.
See, this is a guy looking at culture, having met and engaged Wyndham Lewis, almost started a journal with him, had mastered Finnegan's Wake, the most complex art that people refuse to look at from the 40s up till now. Now they'll do Finnegan's Wake a bit, the younger generation, because of the media environment we're in, so they'd say, oh, maybe this is what the wake's about. But, for 40, 50 years, Marshall's a master of stuff that has not entered the waking life of people in general. He's on another level. And he, in the 40s, Ulysses was locked up in the library of the University of Toronto. Students were not allowed to look at Ulysses. In the 40s, because it was considered pornographic, it had just been unbanned in 1934 in the States. It was banned for many years. So here's this book. It's like Zappa. You know, the Zappa was banned from American radio for most of his career. Real art is ugly to the mainstream bourgeois or whatever, and is a threat and dangerous and looks evil, and it always gets banned. So here's Marshall teaching and an expert on stuff that students have to get permission to allow to look at. So you're looking at someone who's gone metaphorically into many worlds when he's organizing Mechanical Bride, which was written in the 40s. It took him 6 years to get this book published. And remember the story that when the advertising industry found out that this book, which was reviewing ads and comic books and newspaper front pages, when they heard about it, they said, we've got to stop this book. See, there it is. New art will be banned. We used to say on CKLN, if you're an artist, then you better be in jail, like LaRouche or other people. You must be in jail. You're not a bona fide artist today. We were saying that in the 80s. You must be in trouble with the law in some way. And there was McLuhan. The advertising industry was scared, you know, shitless, that he was going to expose something. They just knew. And it's harmless what he does in a way, even though it is super perceptive. And they tried to stop it. So there is a reading banned book.
Did this have anything to do with these ads later being copyrighted then?
Well, that was the reason McLuhan could get away. As McLuhan would say, that the advertising environment was a cliche environment. Everybody took it for granted. So the advertising people never even thought they were doing something that was worth copywriting. And that is why McLuhan did it. He took pop culture images because they weren't copywritten. And when he started to do it, The ad industry said, wait a minute, he's starting to pay attention to what we're doing. We don't want to be analyzed. We don't want anybody to notice what we're doing, because ads try to be subliminal. And so they quickly said, no, this is against the law. And they try to maybe create a law. I don't know the precise details. They try to do something legally to stop him, hoik up a copyright thing, and it didn't work. They couldn't stop it. But certainly McLuhan's book never got any publicity. You know what he did? He had to buy. It didn't sell at all. He had to, he bought all the remainder copies, and he would hand them out to students through the 50s, 60s, and 70s. He was the distributor of the book.
Wow.
And it's so beautiful. Now we're more media savvy, but it's an incredible book. I mean, Carolyn's not impressed with much of anything, and she's actually impressed with Mechanical Bride. She's actually enjoying. This guy was so far ahead of everybody. It's incredible.
It is incredible, and especially just looking at the ads, because another thing about this book is it's not really, when I said it was straightforward, it's not, I don't know when he came up with the medium is the message. It's certainly hinted at in this. He was certainly reading Finnegan's Wake, because he's talking about it all through here. He's talking about Poe, also Margaret Mead. That's another little, that's not
that's
as related
an interesting
to.
That's point. I got a lot of stories
it
about
is.
That. But let me tell you this. Peter Drucker, who became Mr. Management to all the corporations all over the world. You've ever heard of Peter Drucker? He
no.
was the guru for the establishment, you know, the trilateral commission level of telling people what was going on in the economy in the 60s and 70s, probably back in the 50s. Well, he, for his own health and luck, he met McClune in 1940. He was at some conference, and he signed the young McClune, who would have been just about 30. He'd be 30 in 1930. No, he'd be 20. Wait a minute. Yes, he'd be about 30, 29, 30 in 40 or 41. Here's Drucker, who's probably a little older, who had brought Fritz Kramer, the Nazi Galen network who runs the Pentagon and creates Henry Kissinger. It's Drucker who brings Kramer over from Europe at the end of the war.
During Operation Paperclip?
Before Operation Paperclip. Kramer came before World War II, and that's what May Brussel and I exposed, and that's an old subplot in the May Brussel quadrant. But here's Drucker, part of the European establishment. He meets McClune in 1940-41, and he tells about this in his book called Adventures of a Bystander. See, he's a Tetra manager. They just sit on the sidelines, the old financial elite, and watch what's happening, let everything happen. Adventures of a Bystander, and he talks about how his friendship with McClune and Bucky Fuller. He talks about creating Henry Kissinger with Fritz Kramer and all that stuff. So the point is that Drucker says in this probably the essay in Adventures of a Bystander that McClune was essentially saying the medium was a message in his lecture in 1940. He didn't say it that way, but the point that Drucker got from this young professor was what if he didn't understand then, by the 1560s he understood it, because he would use McClune stuff all the time in his books. He says, in retrospect, I now know that McClune could have said it, and he was kind of saying it. And you're right. The Mechanical Bride is saying the medium is the message. That's what it's saying all through the book, if you read it closely.
But it's talking about content. So instead of talking about that in the way that Understanding Media and Extension of the Man did, he's examining content.
Right. But if you notice, he's saying he's trying to create. He says the most important thing in the world is not to become a politician or to become a political activist or a union worker or a successful businessman or a right-winger or left-winger or a bland, liberal, middle-of-the-road. The most important political act is to understand what advertising was doing to people. So that's the content and that's the medium. And all the way through, he's trying to tell people that you can't take a point of view. You can't hate the ads. You don't attack the ads. So he's trying to say, look at the form of the environmental interplay of these media, not the content. Don't get emotionally involved with reacting to the content. That's what he's trying to say, and it doesn't come, he doesn't really say how to do it. You see, he's right there, and this is an interesting point. Is it because he reads Harold Innes in 51 or so that gives him the way to say what he was trying to say in Mechanical Bride? That's a question, an academic question about the evolution of McClune. But now, what's neat is you go read his essays in the 40s. He's actually getting close to it there. And he's saying nobody knows how to talk about this new culture. He knows that. And he's saying we need critical detachment, critical awareness, but not judging and reacting to the content, because that's the red herring. And so you will find in my, I feature in the quotes, you scan the quotes I gave you, I highlight these areas where he's trying to say it. That's what I was doing in my presentation, is to find the...
You know, I took notes the same way that you did, and then I didn't look at yours till I was done, because that's really the natural way to do it. So what I think that you're talking about that you just mentioned, I had written down something on page 75, and he's talking about Poe's The Maelstrom again.
Yes.
It is here suggested that the outlines of world order are already quite visible to the student of the swirling flood released by industrial technique, and they are to be discerned in the very way in which the flood operates. Poe's sailor in The Maelstrom saved him by cooperating with the action of the Strom itself.
Yes, he does in an essay. You know, you have the important part of Da Vinci to Holmes. That's the key to the book in many ways, that section from Da Vinci to Holmes. And the pattern he weaves there of how the scientist is really redoing Sherlock Holmes and this detached detective attitude. And it goes back to Leonardo da Vinci. Now, we are going to play later tonight Ion talking about Michelangelo. So there's an interesting parallel here, totally different, but I just realized, oh, wow, I'm talking about Da Vinci, but we're going to do, you know, his buddy Michelangelo later tonight and how Da Vinci made David, or David, the sculpture. Okay, so here he is saying, he will say somewhere along there that there's an underlying commonality to what's happening in science, what's happening in pop culture, what's happening in music, jazz, advertising, movies. He goes through the whole inventory of arts and sciences and says there's an underlying pattern here, but he doesn't say what it is. He just says you should notice that everybody's subjected to a more hidden, invisible ground, a more hidden, invisible hypnotism. And he doesn't get to say what that hypnotism is until a couple of years later in Explorations magazine, 1953. See, that's really interesting to read, where he begins to say it. So the medium is a message technically doesn't get said till 1957, 58, 59 at a conference to radio people in Vancouver who are worried that TV is making radio obsolete. And so it's McLuhan used to say that's when he first said the phrase, the medium is the message. But he's actually saying it in essays in a couple of years after the book here. So, but you do not find him saying that everything is happening across the board in the 40s, these underlying things, why poetry is the way it is, why Phineas Wake is the way it is, why Hollywood is. He's not pointing out that it's being caused by the mix of radio, movies, and automobiles. And telephones.
Well, he says in the preface that ours is the first age in which many thousands of best-trained individual minds have made it a full-time business to get inside the collective public mind.
Right.
To manipulate, exploit, and control. And I loved this part. He said, and to generate heat, not light, is the intention.
Right. Yes.
To keep everybody in the helpless state engendered by prolonged mental rutting.
And rutting means fucking, you know.
Right.
Mentally screwed. See, there it is. He's saying they're generating heat, emotional. This is what The Adventures of a Bystander is all about. This is what I found. We found this out in 53, 54. The Secret Council 10 was upset that he knew and was pointing that the medium is the message. McLuhan was exposing what the intelligence agents were doing. They were allowing the people to have freedom of speech and to get engaged in issues and become active in many different ways and have the freedom of expressing themselves, which ends up generating lots of heat, right? But no light. And, you know, Marsh is talking as a Catholic there and light, but then that becomes the electric light bulb. It's very interesting what he's saying very quickly in 52. He makes an amazing Medium as a Message article where he nails what it is, what you're looking for, because you've read Understanding Media. He does it a year later in 52. Once McLuhan gets tenure in the middle of 1952, then he's in. You know, he can't be fired as a professor. He gets his tenure, and as soon as he does, he writes this Medium as a Message article. It's an very amazing article. It's like stuff that he would write for Understanding Media 10 years later in Gutenberg Galaxy. So He's hiding. He's holding it back. You see what I'm saying? And you know, he might have even in lectures, like Peter Drucker sees, geez, McClellan said that back in 1940. So I'm an expert in tracking what he says in the 40s, essay by essay, about when did this dawn on him. Because this book, what you're reading, is stuff he's writing in 46, 47. It's really not 1951. He's talking about the meaningless message aesthetically in his reviews of James Joyce by 1949 and 1950, you know, 2 years before the book comes out. So it's good thing to notice. And you just read a great point where he says, you know, they're generating heat but not light. And, you know, Ian comes in and says love is not an emotion because the word love just creates all kinds of heat. You know, and that's emotional interpretations. And so it's a good statement to begin to say love is not an emotion. That agrees with McLuhan.
And I can't wait to read his book on Catholicism. I'm not at my desk. I moved to the couch, so I can't remember what it's called. But it's the one about light.
The medium and the light. That'll give you a whole bunch of orgasms.
The medium and the light.
Because he gives the history of Christianity. It's going to be awesome. You know, you're learning enough to appreciate what he's trying to say about the effect of media over, you know, 3,000 years on religion.
Yeah. Can't wait. Okay, so what do you think? Do you want to do from Da Vinci to Holmes first? Do you want to go through some of the other sections before?
You got any more quotes on where he's trying to say there's something else going on here, people? Don't get distracted by the content, by the heat. Can you find a couple other quotes that he...
Nope, that's really... Well, okay. I wrote down also, and I don't know where these came from right before I started writing down page numbers. Moral indignation is a very poor guide. You can't be mad at what it's doing. You just have to, okay. And the tyrant rules not by club or fist, but through promises of comfort and utility.
Yes. Now, there's a good essay by Marshall, or a book review or something in the late 50s, where he says, for hundreds and thousands of years, the elites ruled by imposition of a myth. Now, this is a devout Catholic talking, but he says the secular management of society was you'd create an idea of good, right, and wrong, and gods and God, and values and morals, and you'd tell people you must control yourself, discipline yourself, you know, control your passions. Okay, so that's the way it was for thousands of years. He says, basically, during World War II or after World War II, he actually says it in Mechanical Bride, look for it, he says, the elites have switched, and they now allow us to have our passions. They're not telling us what's right and wrong. They're going to rule us by letting us run amok with our passions rather than telling us to control our passions. That's the big trick that that my employer said, we got to stop this guy. He's letting them know what we know ourselves. We are going to let people run around and run the show, and they'll think they're running it because there's no way you can run the show by anybody because, as McLuhan says, his technology's come alive. It's the beginning of the Android meme, and humans are obsolete and have disappeared. That's what he's going to be saying in the 50s, and it's implied in extreme statements in The Mechanical Bride. He's saying you don't exist anymore. All you have is your mind, and you're going to have to figure out what the pattern is around here, so you'll be like those in the concentration camps. You're going to be killed, but you want to know why. And that was the pain for Jews. They wanted to know why this was happening. They didn't know why. And that's what. So McLuhan is talking just like that. We're here to help your mind have a reason why things are happening, which is exactly what Ian told us. Millions of people are going around, what's the reason that we're all ridiculous now? In many ways, we're looking for a reason. And you'll hear Ian do a satire on whatever I play tonight about that. He does the city looking for a city, but he changes it to looking for a reason. And the mind, that's the human being. It's very a very mind thing, right, the human.
Mm-hmm.
It's their essence, and they got to have a reason.
So we're all humanity is the mechanical bride. That's not referring to just female, right?
That's right.
We're all
mechanical bride. Well, it's like, you'll see that he'll make comments in the jokes part. Under each ad, he'll have several short one-liners, which are pretty funny. Mm-hmm. They're comedic.
They are.
And he'll say, obviously, the world is designed to make cars. It's for cars. It's not for people. So the mechanical bride is the car, not the wife. People have married their cars. Mm-hmm. And he'll show people the ads. Now, what? Something I thought you might were going to say, what amazes me
and
about
he refers
the ads...
To he refers to the car as being mechanical bride in Understanding Media, too.
Yes, the same title, right.
Mm-hmm, yep.
But I did not grow up with this kind of advertising environment that was in North America. Europe was very nothing. The point is that the ads are incredibly literate. Can you imagine reading those ads? They have a picture and they have all this text and they explain what they're doing. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to read them. Nobody would read that stuff now, right?
I was thinking that exact same thing.
Yeah.
And there's a lot more subliminal stuff now, too.
Yeah, well, you could say non-visual, kinetic, mm-hmm. proprioceptive, and tactile seduction going on, not literate messaging, not a verbal literate messaging. And McLuhan, it got mm-hmm. so different that McLuhan said by the 60s that ads were meant to be not to be noticed. And most people thought that ads were trying to get your attention and you notice them and then you get sucked into the message. No, by the 60s, they're meant not to be noticed. So that's another. And he talked about how it went from advertising went from the hard sell in the 40s to the soft sell in the 60s. It flipped
mm-hmm.
because of the
mm-hmm.
change in media in the global theater. But just looking at the ads, they're interesting about how the corporations would lay out an argument like they were in Parliament and making a defense of what they were doing. And you're supposed to read mm-hmm. this text.
You know, and it was really intelligent text, too. Like, I don't even know if people read stuff that sounds like that anymore.
Well, what
I mean, I'm not saying that people are really stupid, but, I mean, I don't think people are very literate either.
Well,
I mean, they're...
No, wait, Katie. In Furry Lint, you've listened to Who's Forgotten Furry Lint. I think you have. You'll hear at the end of side one, on the first hour, first 30 minutes, McLuhan saying about 1967 that ads were made for people who had the products. So
right.
The only people who read the ads. You'd get the product, and then you'd read the ads to find out what you thought about the product, how you felt
right.
about them, and the audience laughs at that. But that's did people read it? Only after they bought something, then they read it. And that's in the 60s, and they probably did read in the 40s, but people wouldn't read now.
Mm-hmm.
They're not meant to be noticed. The advertising is the hidden ground of support. What would shock people if there weren't any ads? That's when people get suspicious. What if there are no ads on your computer or on television right now? All of a sudden they're not there. And they said that the Marines in World War II, when they were given copies of Life magazine, all the ads would be cut out, and they'd be pissed off. They'd say, look, it doesn't look like a real magazine. There's no ads. It's just articles. They wanted the interplay, tactile interplay, of looking, glancing at ads, maybe reading a few lines, and then looking at the article and going back and forth. That was the true media experience back then in the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
So it felt impoverished without the ads in the magazines.
That's interesting.
Well, the military, you know, maybe they didn't want to support any company, and they're just being efficient. They just think people want to read articles. You know, it's a literate approach. The management of the military, they think, well, these guys want to read and learn stuff, so we'll get rid of the stupid ads.
Mm, or they didn't want them mm-hmm. to think they were missing something.
Right. It's probably mm-hmm. an evil reasons or those kind of manipulative things. But McLuhan's whole point, he would have told those guys, no, the aesthetic experience requires ads to be in there. They're way more important than any article. And he used to say that
mm-hmm.
in the 60s, that ads were so intelligent and so interesting that they made any of the articles in any magazine, you know, anemic. And nobody
mm-hmm.
really felt that. They'd read articles, you know. That I don't know who looked at ads. Maybe women did in Good Housekeeping. I've only noticed women looking at ads. I've never noticed men looking at ads other than in the 50s, 60s, they'd look at car ads. But
mm-hmm.
you didn't think that. I don't think they would agree with McLuhan that the ad was way more important or significant and intelligent than the article. I never heard anybody say that.
Well, there is that section, I have a note on page 58, where he talks about distinction through consumption.
Yes.
So people are...
No, that's my mythic stage idea, but go ahead. People are what?
Well, people have distinction by what they buy, and then they read about it. You know, they read about it in the ad, and then they know what they think about what they buy.
Yeah,
so
back
you don't
then,
have to be like
back then they would read the ads. It seems now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about in the 50s, 60s. Nobody read ads or
oh, okay.
Seriously. But yes, back then because there were text and everything, I guess they were meant to be read. But it was there's a whole section on rivalry and competition, and you were judged by what your clothes were, what product you bought, and if you didn't keep
mm-hmm.
up with the latest new products, you'd start to get in trouble socially. Yes, that's
mm-hmm.
That's consumption by distinction,
mm-hmm.
or distinction by consumption. There, remember,
okay.
in Understanding Media, the section on ads is called Keeping Upset with the Joneses. Not keeping up,
mm-hmm.
keeping upset. And he
mm-hmm.
talks about you never really get restful when you buy something because within 6 months there's a new thing you got to buy to keep up with what you bought.
Mm-hmm. So you're always looking to the future.
Yeah. So, yes.
Okay, we want to do the Da Vinci to Holmes section, and there's many other sections that we can cover, but before we get to Da Vinci to Holmes, one thing I would like to talk about is there's several sections where he talks about the disintegration of the family, that the family has been
yeah.
made too expensive. There's the one heading for failure where there's the two guys and the one who doesn't analograph his finances is headed for failure.
Yeah.
And then there was a section even where he talked about homosexuality.
Yes, it's a defense mechanism in the late 19th century as a sign of social rebellion. That's the Oscar Wilde generation. They do not want to become increasingly seen as conformists, so they became homosexual as a political statement. But then he talks about in the 40s and 50s that because the women were taking over the home and were
mm-hmm.
dominating, more, starting to become the blondies, the man
right.
was second rate, losing his purpose. And you'll see he talks about man as abstract and not really able to handle the information society. So women have an advantage, so they're feeling inferior. And then one of the reactions to that was, fuck it, I'm going to hang out with men so you become homosexual.
Well, there was also just like sex weariness and sex sluggishness because
yes.
of the barrage of all of the sex in the ads.
Now, wait a minute. It's not just barrage. People are listening to the radio and they're on the phone. They're experiencing the beginning of the electronic landscape. Not a body yet,
okay.
but they're having the sensory dynamics of listening and sharing the radio environment. And then the TV
okay.
environment. This sensory, discarnate, disembodied, electronic thing is a drug, and therefore the old physical functions are starting to become weak and not as attractive
mm-hmm.
or not as satisfying. And that leads to sexual sluggishness. And also leads to the sexual revolution where sex is not even important anymore, so you do it with anybody anywhere you want. So you don't bring in morals anymore. So that the hidden ground of the sexual revolution was people preferred the electric effect.
Okay, so and that's all so interesting. And my specific question is, and he says on page 99, it makes inevitable both a divorce between physical pleasure and reproduction and also the case for homosexuality. In the era of thinking machines, it would be surprising indeed if the love machine were not thought of as well. So here's my question, like, all this talk about whether homosexuality is a choice or not, or if you're born gay or not, and it's the civil rights issue of our times and gay marriages and all this kind of stuff. Like, were there this many gay people before there were all this extension through technology? And I know that's the most politically incorrect question that a person is, I mean, I probably shouldn't even ask that if anyone else can hear me, but I want to know the answer.
Well, that's
what
we, I think.
We talked about that a little bit last week when you were talking about Ellen.
Yes, I back in the 80s, and there were a lesbian caucus that took over the station, a lesbian black caucus almost. They That's partly my joke about the black woman. I was claiming it was a black woman so I could handle, I would not be fired by the new management at CKLM.
Oh.
As a matter of fact, I just emailed Poonam, who was manager back then. She takes over from Adam Vaughan, who's now running, trying to become mayor of Toronto and part of that Rob Ford thing that Daniel mm-hmm. Libby calls in about. Well, Poonam is the one who took over in 1987, June 87. And I understand she was a lesbian, seemed to be a lesbian, and she brought in a lot of lesbian programmers. It became quite controversial between the old heterosexual male guys and the new female caucus. And then they had a Marva Jackson was the black station manager in there just before or after. No, when was that? She was in there with Poonam. So Poonam, I bumped into her in New York City in, say, 2005. We had a pleasant talk, but there were two women with her, and they didn't seem to want to have her talk to a guy too long. So we just did a little bit, and then we're supposed to hook up, but we didn't. And so just a few months ago, I emailed her out of the blue, because we emailed back in 2008, to tell her I wanted to read her PhD. She's up there at York University in Toronto. And I want to tell her about the drops and all that, because she asked me in 1995, when I came back to Toronto at one point, she said, I understand Carol's doing some interesting stuff in Mir and this stuff, and she expressed an interest in it, which is surprising to me because we never talked about much when I was there as a programmer. And so I want to know what she was doing with her PhD and all this stuff. So I said, hey, RNA drops, you might want to look at this. Haven't heard back. I may have been banned from wherever she is or something, so I don't know what's going on there, but I'm always creating these little dramas, you know, based on stuff from 25 mm-hmm. years ago. So mm-hmm. so this whole lesbian thing, I would get on there and talk about the nonsense about the gay issue from the electrified, discarnate state. That was the real political issue, not whether you were gay or not and homosexual. And we're so different now that we would not be able to project accurately what was going on in 1910. Or 1830 or something. I mean, did you know that Greece, Athens, was based on homosexuality? That was
well,
the
I had that thought.
Mm-hmm.
Well, isn't that supposedly one of the reasons why that culture fell?
No, it fell because it got the phonetic alphabet, and then the visual space moved over to Rome, who had the Rhodes and Papyrus. You know, the media, always look at the media as the first reason
sure.
everything happens. You know, the change in technologies and communication media. That's the McLuhan's point. It's the biggest factor in human history. And then the other issues, which are never resolvable. You can't resolve stuff about the body or about sexuality or
right.
men, women, who's smarter, who's stupider, you know. But you can look at which one fits the media of the day. And that's what the book Alphabet and the Goddess is about, and that's what I recommend to Hillary to read before if we do the show. So, yes, all these issues, the only way to talk about it and not appear politically correct or incorrect is to use the media level. You see? And that's
okay,
why here's the subplot. McLuhan knew that he'd come up with an Esperanto, a language of uniting all the fractional issues, political, sociological, correct or not, if you start talking about the media as extension of the senses on a more broader general level, which is practical because everybody engages the media, if you do that, then people can come together and not get hassled over whether they're racially, class-wise, or sexually connected.
Okay.
So
that makes sense.
Yeah, so this is so you can so what is it quite? Okay, are people gay by birth, by conditioning, by genes, or by sociality?
Or by extension of the extensions of man through media.
Right, right. And now Zappa, he wrote Bobby Brown, this great song, where he proposes that this all-American guy, Bobby Brown, because he meets this dyke named Freddie, and she has some sex with him, it so screwed him up that he gives up and becomes gay. So Frank raised the question, not from the sophisticated level of McLuhan, but he knew media more like Frank Zappa's on the Mechanical Bride level. He sees the conditioning through messages and advertising because he was an ad executive himself or an ad employee when he was nearly 20. So he's saying that the people are becoming gay because it's a fad and for other reasons than biology.
Okay.
So he's got close to McLuhan, but what do the gay people say? Well, then allow me to be married, allow me to be have economic rights and all that stuff that regular citizens have. That's probably an argument that you couldn't go against. But once they get the rights to have a family and to be married and all that, they will be subjected to the same stresses and strains as a hetero family has, which McLuhan lays out in Mechanical Bride. You can't have a family. He said in the 60s, you have a car, you can't have a family. He says the family got destroyed with the automobile in the 20s. Because, yeah, Carolyn?
And that's why we don't have a car.
And that's why we're the only couple still around, still married, because we don't have a car. We had to sacrifice kids, you know, because of so many other electronic distractions, but we are the only family still left. A very small, tiny family that participates in none of the family rituals, like Christmas, Easter, Halloween, or church. Or just maintaining the right to be a man and a woman in it. And well, we claim we're the first to reappear as the new man and woman with eternal energy, right? That led to Ion.
Yeah.
Yeah, so anyways, back to... hey, Carol, I'll say something else.
Bob sees me go for the mute.
Yeah.
He maintained the right to be wrong.
We do?
Yeah.
No.
When you
no.
said the right to whatever, I thought...
You don't. She doesn't fully understand this. She's just starting to read Mechanical Bride. She wants to find out how we won. How did this happen, Bob? I mean, she was part of making the winning happen, but she didn't fully understand how we pulled it off. Only I do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, while we're talking about the man and the woman thing, what was McLuhan's relationship with Margaret Mead? Did he ever meet her? Because I know her book, Male and Female, I think that I looked that came out in 49, so that would have been 2 years before this.
Right.
But were they chums? Tell me. Were they chums? Tell me. I just want to know what you know about their relationship.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. It's a big story, and I'll tell you in a second, but there was something just before that. You know, they talk about a Masters of Sex, that documentary or that drama, is showing the women who worked in factories. The myth is they worked in factories during World War II, and then after the war, everybody went back to the nuclear family. And so you have the women in the 50s are presented as very cloistered and protected and isolated in their suburban homes and rather in a vulnerable, weakened state. As their husband.
Douching with Lysol. Has Carolyn gotten to the point yet where they're saying you should douche with Lysol? That's the most disgusting thing I've ever heard of.
Oh my gosh, that's disgusting.
That's an ad dainty. Promoting?
Mm-hmm.
So you can stay dainty.
Oh gosh.
Wow. So here you have the women, being fragile, yet McLuhan's saying, no, the women are strong and they're taking over. You can look at the women going into becoming the housewife and the important nuclear family imagery of the 50s is that the woman is protecting the family because it knows it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
So the man is out there taking advantage of new technology, reading Playboy, fantasizing over Hugh Hefner's vision, and being a consumer and enjoying the abundance of the 1560s, so the men are hired to stay in the family, and probably most of them are having affairs all over the place, and weren't preserving the family. You know, they didn't care about the nuclear family, but they could never admit that. But you could see the women retreated and tried to save biology. They tried to save the chemical body. That's a different way to look at the supposed submissive tyranny that women were under in the 50s. They were trying to preserve the biological form. The biological form is nothing by 1970, so all kinds of revolutions can come out that express indifference to biological control, you know, through the birth control pill. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Marshall, he also talked about it was kind of in the Dagwood section, but in other places too, the destabilization of the male role in society, because without the womb, which we talked about at closing last week, but because they didn't have the biology, that they that their role became destabilized. That's all I
That's
really
right.
want to say.
They're abstract, okay. And they, he says that they, I have that quote on my list. He says, man's role in society is tenuous from the beginning. It's abstract and tenuous. It doesn't, he's engaged in maybe making rituals and codifying laws and doing a little hunting, but McLuhan says the woman is very involved with biology and preserving the race or something, or just being more, has a more obvious role of nurturing the next generation. So, what happens in that, now there's a leftist writer, forget her name now, right now, she wrote in the 80s that the beatnik revolution of the late 50s, early 60s was man realizing he didn't have to be the patriarch in the home anymore. The American male realized, shit, man, I can get in my car, I got radio, I can have TV, I got all this stuff to stimulate me. I don't need to hang around with my with one woman or one kid, bunch of kids. And so the beatnik thing was male hedonism took over. And so the Dagwood he describes in The Mechanical Bride, the suppressed, lethargic, no-role Dagwood of the 40s and 50s is obsolesced by television, spaceships, and all that happens in the late media environment of the late 60s and early late 50s, early 60s. It frees the man to run amok. And Barbara, what's her name, writes about this in retrospect. Wait a minute, that's women. We're all fooled by this. And
was it Barbara Hubbard? Barbara Marx Hubbard?
No, no, it's a leftist academic. I know who they are. Anyways, Barbara Marx Hubbard. But so here's the thing: that McLuhan definitely knew that the world had changed by 1964 when he comes up with Understanding Media. That his Mechanical Bride was not addressing huge changes that happened in 15 years, and so, but his motives, his aesthetic, his using Finnegan's Wake are still used in the new books, just like he used them. He still uses the Edgar Allan Poe Maelstrom story. The same themes are used to the same purpose, but he is forced, and that was his genius. I mean, he writes his avant-garde science fiction incredible book, Mechanical Bride, and only he is smart enough to notice that that book is obsolete, even though it was great, and he had to write a different kind of book in the 60s and be a different kind of person, which shocked all the professors in that new Mechanical Bride. They said, that guy was a genius when he wrote Mechanical Bride, but now he's given up. He's like, doesn't have any criticism going on. And they didn't understand his new, very detached position, new level. So the change...
The writing is really different. It's a totally different voice.
Right. It's a private lyrical voice, almost. It's the lyrical voice.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's three kinds of literature: lyric, epic, and dramatic. Well, he moves into the dramatic mode with Understanding Media. He's performing. Mm-hmm. He's faking being a person. He's faking having a non-opinion. He's doing all kinds of role-playing. He's not doing that so much in Mechanical Bride.
Mm-hmm.
And but that's where you read my essay for the details of that. So, okay, so here
I do want to read it.
Right,
okay,
so the beatnik thing has totally changed. So the men of the 60s are not Dagwood and Bumstead. They're now I Spy, Mission Impossible, James Bond. James Bond is the model for the new man, post-satellite, post-Sputnik.
Mm-hmm.
And Emmett Cohen picked that up right away. As soon as the James Bond movies were happening, you know, he was always tossing off. He said it's a CIA world, it's a James Bond world. He put James Bond together with the CIA paranoia that people were starting to have because of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So we got onto this because you're talking about the men, and what were you trying to say with Dagwood? The men are suppressed. Yes, they are in the 40s and 50s, but they're not in the 60s. And then the women catch on to this 10 years later by the early 70s. And that's right when McLuhan said, when women's lips start showing up. And back then, you wouldn't be aware of it, but most of society was outraged at women's lib. It was wrong. It was bad, you know, just like any other new wrinkle. And so McLuhan was the only guy who wasn't thrown by it. He says, look, these women are looking for total mobility. which means access to cars and movies and TV and radio and consuming all this multimedia environment on their own in their own time, like men have been doing for 10 or 15 years. And what are men doing? They're moving into invisible surveillance roles. They're not going to be visible anymore. So man was starting to become invisible like James Bond, and the women said, oh, the men aren't occupying the visible institutions. Let's take them over. Let's have total mobility. It wasn't about whatever the ideological things that Kate Millett or Germaine Greer or Gloria Steinem wrote about. It was a technological change, and the women responded. They went to preserving no longer the family, but to preserving civilization, at least the Gutenberg Galaxy version. Mm-hmm. That's why women became lawyers and doctors and all these specialist bullshit roles that the men had abandoned. The real men.
Okay,
I mean, the highest levels of understanding and intelligence activity, you know.
Right. And that we've shot off on that tangent from talking about Margaret Mead, who I don't know all that much about, although
no,
I
let me tell you
that
about
she
Margaret
had
Mead.
Three husbands.
Like
she
yes.
advocated serial monogamy. She had her college starter husband, and then she had those two other guys. Because she's often quoted as a person, as a, like I have some friends who are into polyamory, and they'll often quote her as an advocate of serial monogamy. Like, we're not wired to have one spouse.
Yeah, that's something we'll have to talk about. That's the new fad right now. Polyamory?
Mm-hmm. Amory, yeah.
Carolyn goes monogamy. Carolyn doesn't have a clue. It's not polymonogamy, Carolyn.
Yeah, it's like you monogamize one person and divorce them and then monogamize the next person.
No, the new polyandry, A-N-D-R-Y, right?
No, A-M-O-R-Y, as in love, A-M-O-R-Y.
Oh, polyamory is what they're saying. Okay,
yeah.
Not polyandry.
Yeah.
So polyamory, Carolyn, is you don't divorce anybody. You just have many, many relationships, like a good quadriphenic. Okay, so that's the new fad. I don't know what is it your generation is doing this? The 20-year-olds?
A little bit younger, 15 years younger.
It's more point of the obsolescence of the chemical body, so you do not look for any sustenance in the chemical body. So why would you have one person for emotional meaning or intellectual meaning or physical meaning? That's not enough for a multi-body quadriphrenic citizen. You know what I mean? It's ridiculous. So they just gave up. They just gave up and said, I'll just fuck anything that moves when I want to and whatever. Disconnect from my people I've already fucked. So it's the friends with benefits kind of thing. It's like now it's marriage with benefits.
Right.
They're not even married. Okay, back to Margaret. Let's do Margaret Mead. You want to read, you want to go to LaRouche's website and Executive Intelligence Review and put in Margaret Mead and read all the articles they have on Margaret Mead. She's the most evil person in the world, according to LaRouche. She's the head of the CIA, the NSA. She is the top archetype from the 40s, because she's a key person in the Macy conferences, which studied the cybernetics and the new digital world that Marshall started to critique in the early 50s. So here's Margaret Mead, and she's married eventually to Gregory Bateson, who goes on to do MK Ultra in the late 50s and give LSD to Jerry Rubin, Jerry Garcia of Grateful Dead, and Ken Kesey. He's running that show in Palo Alto. Gregory Bateson is the other most evil guy. So here, if Margaret and Gregory together at some point, and then they split, right? Okay.
Right.
Now, McLuhan is up on everything all the time. So he picks up on Margaret Mead as a very intelligent, important writer, and he says in Mechanical Bride that her book is very useful and even attempts to point out what he's pointing out. But, of course, she doesn't have the Joycean Wyndham Lewis expertise, so she fails or doesn't do it completely, but she's groping towards it. That's another thing about understanding about Mechanical Bride. McLuhan is taking, he still has quotes in there, more of his writing, but he's got lots of quotes of intellectuals, and he's using them to build up his case, but he says none of them really get what he's trying to get other than Siegfried Gideon, who was a personal friend of James Joyce and buried James Joyce. So Siegfried Gideon is an important man in there. He's an architect, writes about history of architecture. So Gideon...
McLuhan, he talks about that Mumford again a lot, too.
Yes, he says Mumford and Gideon are very important, and Margaret Mead. You could say Toynbee, Margaret Mead, Gideon, and whatever other one I left out. They are figures of a new ground, a new way of doing, you know, intellectual academic research. But he knows that they're responding to a hidden ground that they're not fully aware of to the degree he's aware of. But he hasn't found a way to say it yet. You know what I mean? But he is, he knows who are the best people to quote. You know, he goes to the best geniuses. So he is very impressed with Margaret Mead. Now, she does not engage with the explorations. I don't think she's in explorations in the 50s. And a lot of the elites got into his journal because it was a very important journal. Now, in 1963, an architect guy called Doxiadis, a Greek, Doxiadis or something, D-O-X-I-A-D-I-S, something like that. You can look it up in the letters. He starts an annual boat tour in the Mediterranean. He has a yacht. And it gets the elite, the intellectual elite together to hang out on the boat for a few days and have seminars and panels. It's like the first retreat, just like Esalen Institute started to be like that in the same period in the early to mid-60s. So Marshall McLuhan is invited to it, I think, in 1963-64. He's starting to be noticed by the Margaret Mead International Intellectual Jet Set. So he's invited to be on the boat and be with these intellectuals, and I knew what was going on there through my intelligence network, but I don't know what he thinks till I find out later. He tells me about being on the boat in 63, and he doesn't go back till like 72. And he points out to me, very pointedly looking at me, saying, "You know, Bob, Margaret Mead never missed a summer on that boat." And he didn't say anything anymore. So Marshall implied that he knew that Margaret Mead was an important gatekeeper in trilateral commission levels that Alex Jones objects to. You know what I'm saying?
Sure. Yep.
So he actually has the same suspicion of her as LaRouche does. But Marshall is not reacting to that. He doesn't. He says, "Well, that's just the white race trying to preserve itself, even though it's a losing cause since we're all going virtual." He doesn't get so upset about it like he does in the boat advertising, you know what I mean? But he's not fooled by what's going on. And he says, so he's implying Margaret Mead has to be at every boat trip to notice who's here. She's the one who's actually marking the papers, so to speak. So you got that remark, and he does write a couple of letters to her. So they're correspondence, but she keeps her distance, and that's suspicious. She doesn't. You know, Jane Jacobs, the famous New York architect who caused the revolution against Robert Moses in New York City, she moves to Toronto and becomes an associate and makes a film of McLuhan. Now, that's to her credit. She had the guts to hang out with McLuhan. Margaret Mead didn't. So that's all I can add to it, other than it's totally irrelevant what any of them thought about anything, because we're in a totally new situation with Ion here, but... And when we're sitting in the interval and thinking back about who was doing what to who, that's what I would add from the McLuhan level.
Well, and most people will know. I would never think that about Margaret Mead. I mean, I think about her going to tribal people and, like, hanging out and drumming and being in the mud and things like that. I mean, I don't
think
about
her. Well, that was intelligent. Now, you read LaRouche, you'll go through the whole history of anthropology. It always was a British intelligence operation. To control the emerging third world nations.
Oh, wow. That just sounds like a total dingbat, but wow,
no, that's good.
I just thought she was genuinely interested, you know, like in
She was, but why is an anthropologist involved with cybernetics?
That's what I'm saying. And MK Ultra and LSD.
Yeah. Why?
Oh my gosh! That is. I wonder if they ever gave any LSD to any of those tribal people.
No, I don't think so. They were too worried about Americans. Remember, the international intelligence agencies were trying to control the United States. That's what was breaking out and ruining civilization or the old ways of control. Which McLuhan, you will see in there, he says he has a line in there. He's talking about how bad it is, but he says also though, there's more and more independent minds growing right now, way more than one would think. He's talking about the decentralized, if you want to look at it as positive, the decentralizing effect that was starting to happen. And he caught that. Mm-hmm. So he's celebrating what the Beatniks celebrate 10 years before the Beatniks.
Right. Well, and in Cliché de Archetype, it talks more about the West and the East, not like, you know, like Oriental, Occidental.
That's
and
right.
Meditation and the Beatles and all that. Where this is talking more about like Africa, things like that, like third world. I mean, I know there's poor. I'm not very good at like knowing what's going on in the
now,
world.
This is
so
why the
different.
Next.
But you know what I mean. That there's difference between having
what
like.
Mean. Here's what you don't know. You mean you need the next
thank
thing
you.
Is to get the letters, and you read what he's writing to people at the time Mechanical Bride comes out, what happens just after that. And he's investigating secret societies, and he's talking about the cult of the East and the cult of the West. That's sort of embedded in Mechanical Bride. He probably stuck that in at the last minute, but it's more developed in Explorations, his magazine thing. So the cult of the East, cult of the West, he says, I will have nothing to do with either. So he's moving to the tactile gap in between them. And that is actually what he's trying to show in The Mechanical Bride, the gap you can move into between, you know, hating edge or worrying about the end of your body and all this stuff. You operate in the gap, in the tactile interval, then you're in a new position which can't be controlled by the authorities. You don't have a position for them to get mad at. So they don't know the position you have because you're in the interval. So the East and West becomes a symbolic battle of the secret societies in his writing in the 50s. And then it becomes, in Understanding Media, eye versus ear. And then in Cliché Archetype, it becomes cliché versus archetype. So you have these pairs happening all the way through his writing from the 30s, early 40s, all the way up. Each new technology makes a new dialectic.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's so interesting.
Right. So the dialectic in Mechanical Bride is between highbrow art and lowbrow art. Or highbrow culture that the Norman Mailers are writing about versus the lowbrow culture of advertising, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the dialectic of culture. That's why when he redoes Mechanical Bride in 1970, the book is called Culture is Our Business, which is what he was trying to say. I never said those words, but he said that pattern in 1951. He's pointing out the information side he's taking over, and generally he's presenting it as a flood or a drowning, or a disappearing of the mind. So it's like the mind, the individual mind, and the culture hero artist versus the collective art that advertising represents.
Mm-hmm.
And he says advertising is the greater art than anything Norman Mailer, Saul Bellow, or Bernstein, Leonard Bernstein, or any culture vulture did. Now, you imagine trying to tell that to your average citizen in 1950 that ads are the real culture. When the American citizen is just taking advantage of the GI Bill, going to college, learning how to get a specialist role, some of them are in the humanities, they want to become an art critic or an artist, and they value all these old humanities roles, and they don't know they're already obsolete. So McClellan's on the sideline sniping at them all through the 50s and 60s. You know, that's what you see in his letters, he invades corporate heads and all kinds of status people. He writes some letters to sort of shock them. And so that's what he's doing. He's probing all the time through his letters. And you get a lot of explanation in his letters and answers to your questions there.
Okay, I'd love to read
those. What he's personally thinking. At least he registers what he's personally thinking in his letters. But he's not limited to what he's personally thinking in his actions. He knows he doesn't exist. He knows that the chemical body is obsolete. He is trying to be a English language in relation to other media.
Mm-hmm. What does that mean? I don't understand that.
He's not being univocal. And he's saying English.
Okay.
He's not being like Churchill. He says Churchill mobilized English in World War II. Marshall would not mobilize English. He would preserve English and book culture indirectly by talking about whether the society should have TV or not. He even says, you notice that line, he says, it's now coming to the point where we will now debate whether a man has the right to invent something and become rich. This may cause too much upset. So the thing he gives the step by step how you would explain mediacology, without saying turn off TV for 6 months. He never gets that far, but he tells you the mm-hmm. thinking in that book about if you think you want to preserve civilizational values that you think you're standing for and going to fight Korea and fight the communists for, you've become the most communist society in the world, and yet you're fighting the bureaucratic communists over there in Korea. You're running around doing Custer's Last Stand to preserve these values. So you begin to, he says, look at the situation. Your values aren't even possible anymore. That's what his mm-hmm. way of, in other words, he would say, okay, once you realize that, you say, yeah, we better turn off TV. We're not ready for it. If we want to preserve what we're doing and what we think we're standing for, we wouldn't allow TV to be in the society for a few decades.
Mm-hmm.
And so he says that in the later 50s, and he doesn't say Mechanical Bride, but Mechanical Bride presents all the reasons why one should, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, he talked about in, what book was it? It was in War and Peace in the Global Village. Yeah, about every human's dignity requires that he produce and enjoy general affluence. So how does that fit into what you just said about...
Yes, he says the biggest the problem for the unions, or even the leftists and Marxists, is that every human yearns to be an aristocrat.
Yeah, that's why the ads work.
Right, and it makes... So in the long run, now... Some of the radicals I talked to in New York City used to say that the unions capitulated in the 50s. They went for middle-class lifestyle and having a car and the general abundance of middle class. Not aristocratic wealth, but just sort of giving up on sticking to their guns and not allowing the management to run the show. They gave up and started to move to the suburbs, leave the cities, and become politically apathetic and enjoy radio, TV, and cars. So that is the beginning of the hedonistic desire, the natural sensual desire to become an aristocrat, have autonomy, and do whatever you want to, whenever you can, however, you know, have abundance, have total mobility. And that did in the unions. So... the technology's obsolete. Any of the old kinds of social community and hierarchy of social community was obsolete as the body, chemical body, became obsolete. And he writes about that. He writes in The Mechanical Bride the obsolescence of biology. Biology, Darwin is obsolete by the 20th century. It's not true that we evolved by nature. We evolved by media.
Uh-huh. And the pocketbook is the gland of the new body politic.
And the body politic is advertising.
Mm-hmm.
That's the juice, the fuel that keeps the whole thing lubricated. It is the actual Esperanto, the blood of the new body politic, the circulation.
Oh, my gosh. That's so interesting. Really interesting. Okay, so... Let's do Da Vinci to Holmes, but before we do that, will you tell me what is his deal with Poe? Because we have to talk about Poe a little bit because he did the backward construction of the crime genre. He was the first one to do that, Poe, as a writer.
He reads Edgar Allan Poe's story, Descent into the Maelstrom, probably in the 30s, because he's talking about... He does a whole essay on the Edgar Allan Poe and his tradition, or the Edgar Allan Poe tradition, I forget the title, in the mid-40s. So Edgar Allan Poe is very important even before he's writing Mechanical Bride, and he makes Edgar Allan Poe
I just want to say one thing, too. I did read a little bit about Poe, I mean, not his relationship with Marshall, obviously, but I did not know that he was one of the first, if not the first, American novelist to be able to support himself through writing.
Right. He's really important. He also, now you can read LaRouche and Poe, he was an intelligence agent and worked against Charles Dickens. And that's a whole interesting dynamic, if you believe LaRouche's historical stuff. But LaRouche
is that because he wanted to be the Dickens of America?
No, he did not like the effect of Dickens and what Dickens represented. But that's something, you have to read LaRouche's stuff. And LaRouche is... he presents a lot of literary data to back his case, but most people don't believe it. So But it's an interesting...
Did you see that a movie's coming out about Dickens' life?
No, I didn't see that.
I just saw an interview the other day. It's some really good actor. I'll have to look it up for you because I can't remember, but as soon as I hear it, I'll remember. But it's about, it's called, I think, The Invisible Woman, about an affair that he had with a young girl who was his muse. But since
right.
he was famous, she chose not to be seen.
Well, that's just a bunch of baby boomer fucking female directors trying to make a big deal out of the chemical body of women, you know? That's not...
I'm still going to go see it.
Oh, yeah. Well, what else is there to do when you're obsolete
Free
body?
McLuhan.
You go to
right.
the movie. Yeah. When you're not talking about McLuhan, then you got to do something
right.
else. Right? So that's your alibi. I took a break from McLuhan, go watch some content. And politically
right.
wrong content. Sociologically
right.
wrong, immediately wrong, wrong all the time, automatically before we even see the movie. We know that because they're not allowed to do it the level we're talking about. It's very interesting. One of the first parallel worlders that Ion talked to us about was Edgar Allan Poe. Either he got that or it's important regardless of my mind. But, you know, I had done a lot on Poe through LaRouche and McLuhan and other people through the years. But in the particular, in the McLuhan case, in The Descent of the Maelstrom, he tells the famous story, or Poe tells the story, two brothers are out there fishing, a storm comes up, and obviously the boat's going to go down, so one brother ties himself to the mast of the boat and figures that'll prevent him from being blown overboard or something, and the other brother doesn't do that, but he watches his brother tied to the mast get dragged down and drown. And so what's the other brother going to do? And he starts noticing, some of these barrels go down into the maelstrom, the whirlpool, and then pop back up. So he put himself, he grabbed a barrel and knew he'd have to hold his breath, I guess, as he got sucked down into the whirlpool, but he knew it would be pop back up. So he understood the movement of the maelstrom, and therefore he survived. So McLuhan makes that a metaphor. How do you understand the movement of these multimedia environments in the 20th century? You got to have a detached view. You don't try to take a position and hold on. You find out what's going to go be obsolescent and retrieved.
Okay.
Right? Sucked down.
So did Poe know what he was writing about?
Yeah, Poe wrote it. He knew something.
But, I mean, he wasn't talking about a fucking whirlpool, was he, really?
Yeah, that's what the story's about. The story's called Descent.
I know, but is it a metaphor? I read the poem. I thought it was a poem.
The story. Descent. Well, you read it, but we won't dwell on that.
I did it like 2 weeks ago, and
okay.
I don't really remember. And it was the same time I looked up Rag and Bone Shop, actually. I read
okay.
both
of those. Descent into the maelstrom means descent into the whirlpool. And why did the second brother survive it? That's what the story's about.
I know, but I'm saying, was it a metaphor? Or was
had any human being ever done what he has his character do? Grab a barrel?
No, and he lived in the Bronx, so he probably didn't go do that in the Bronx.
He lived in other parts of the States before that. I think he was down in Baltimore
okay.
and that. But he's probably all over the place. He's also in Europe. He was an intelligence agent, so he probably learned a lot of different things that are not on his record. Remember, he's only buried because his body's found in the ditch. And Ian says because he fell out of the gap, or he fell out of the rift. He was parallel worlding and fucked up, couldn't get back, and got trapped, and so he died. You know, and his body.
Really?
Oh yeah, that's been talked about in Cashflow many times. That's in there somewhere.
Well, I've missed that. I need to find that.
So anyway,
what a loser.
Oh, he was pretty hip.
I'm a loser for not hearing that.
We'll agree with that. So mm-hmm. So if no one had ever actually survived by grabbing a barrel and going down the thing and only pop up and survive that way, then Poe's pretty imaginative or pretty knowledgeable, and he made up something that no one had ever done. But it's a pretty neat survival or story about how to survive. So Poe also invents the detective story, which is writing the effects preceding the causes and having the technique of the suspended judgment. The maelstrom guy who survived, yeah, he's detached. He's looking at it. So McLuhan takes that story and makes it his secular religion totem talisman. He says, this is how you survive today. You learn what to hold on to that you know is going to be retrieved. not in the sense of an opinion, or not as, as a defensive reaction, conserving. You look at the process and maybe not even jump onto a barrel, but just understand how things are going to flow. So let's see. I got to go upstairs. Carol's making some pancakes, making some rude noises, so I got to go upstairs. So this story, he says, is the key to understanding the maelstrom that advertising is creating, the media environment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
McLuhan, all right? He uses right. the metaphor, it's mentioned, I think, right on the first page in the preface, and he refers to it throughout the book, and he actually mm-hmm. says, well, he actually writes an essay in the mid-40s stating this as a solution. But now, what's interesting, in the Da Vinci to Holmes chapter, he is saying that detached perspective that Poe and Sherlock Holmes and Da Vinci and other writers and artists all the way through 500 years or 400 years of culture is a demonic position. It's the devil. You have to notice this. Here he has Poe as his story is very important for psychic survival, but actually Poe himself lived the life of the aristocratic rake, like Lovelace in Richardson's novel, like who's the other one in the Jane Eyre novel? What they are, they're these aristocratic guys who come into the bourgeois community and upset everything. They seem to be not attached to middle-class values. This is what the essay's about, that archetype, right?
Is that Heathcliff?
Heathcliff, yes, Heathcliff.
Okay,
there's
right.
Lovelace in one novel, Heathcliff in another novel, and these are the aristocratic dandies or free dandies, and they are the model that comes from Da Vinci of the Renaissance man who does, mm-hmm. who objects to the new commercialized middle classes.
Okay.
So you say some more about the chapter. I've started off.
I didn't pick up on like the. I thought it was kind of a. When you say it's. Did you say it was the devil? So this is like
yes.
a bad thing?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, he does talk on page 108 about what this person is.
Right.
So you've got this new Renaissance man, the sleuth, and he's got
later.
Knowledge of literature.
Let's do the steps. The sleuth is
okay.
later. It's Da Vinci to Holmes. So Da Vinci is first, the guy who's not your average guy. He's a genius. He's a Renaissance man. He's not in the hoi polloi. He's not hanging out with the average commoner. He's making incredible technologies. And he's a genius. And then that is the beginning of the Superman, who is usually an aristocrat in relation to the beginning of the growth of the mercantilist class or the middle class. And so you have
okay.
novels written in the 1700s which present that kind of guy, that aristocrat, whose ancient regime or feudalistic society has fallen apart and no longer supportable. And the aristocrat's a bit pissed off about this. So the aristocrat makes a new role for himself. He becomes the outsider. And in the novels, he's presented as rather dangerous to people, dangerous to their social...
So he would be the murderer then, not the sleuth.
No. You'll see later in the essay that the detective and the policeman create violence. They're obsessed with murder. So they create the murder dynamic by their obsession, which is an ionic statement. You know, those that look for the disease create the disease. But go back and look at it carefully. He goes step by step.
Okay, so on 109, page 109, it talks about, however, a major feature of the modern sleuth, notably absent from Poe's Dupin, or maybe it's Dupin or something.
Dupin is the detective in Poe's stories.
Okay.
And so Dupin is the first detective. And he's
okay.
like 40 years before Holmes.
Okay. Is the quality of the manhunter. The Superman features don't change from Da Vinci to Byron and Heathcliff, but the manhunting proclivities, the endless sniffing out along the road to the supreme metaphysical thrill of murder, are not evident until home. So that's what you're talking about.
Right.
Right?
That's an important point. There's a transitional from the Lord Byron aristocrat who's out there fighting for the people or for something, you know, as a radical. If Byron is at the beginning, 1800s, now Holmes is at the end of the 1800s. Now, McLuhan makes the important point there are several phases that go on in between. The first is James Fenimore Cooper's novels of Chingachgook and The Noble Savage, which also comes from Rousseau. So The Noble Savage is this person with fully developed sensory life. He's not visually biased. He's capable of doing anything, and he can take scalps, and he can enjoy, killing people if he needs to survive. So The Noble Savage, McLuhan says, is the transition from the Byron dandy, and then you have The Noble Savage. Then you have Baudelaire and the actual dandies in France. They're a phase of social rebellion, which leads to Oscar Wilde.
Is Tarzan one of the savage ones?
Yes, Tarzan is a later variation of that, a replay of that in the 20th century. So you get to you have to get to Holmes, who is obsessed with murder and is interested in the metaphysical meanings of it and how can a human do this. He's totally fascinated by murder. That cannot happen until the pop culture goes through the James Fenimore Cooper phase of the noble Indians and the Superman Indians, super Indians.
Okay.
And so that that brings murder and scalping in so that the white man, through Holmes, can start to engage it. So it's very subtle. You have to read the chapter carefully because McLuhan's pointing out that, yes, Holmes is going after the murderers, but he is actually fascinated to the point of being at disservice with the murdering dynamic. Now you bring Ion in and says, do not be concerned about people getting murdered, right? Ion takes it further. This is the fascinating part of what we're reading in McLuhan leads to the extreme positions on the surface of Ion. Actually, Ion's the next level. Anyways, at least Holmes is still trying to supposedly stop people who have murdered the people. You know, he's trying to have some social function. So then you have Holmes is the first a new kind of detective. And then you have in the 20th century movies, newspapers, books, comics are littered with this aristocratic noble savage type. And that's Tarzan, Raymond Chandler's Philip Marlowe character. He's the sophisticated. He's the guy going around in the city, like Baudelaire did in the 50s in Paris, 1850s. He was a urban romanticist. He didn't celebrate nature. He celebrated the aesthetic experiences of the city. So that was new. So Baudelaire is part of this aristocratic dandy evolution. So you have in the 20th century the detective. You could have the Untouchables, Dick Tracy, different variations, but the sophisticated one is Philip Marlowe, written by Raymond Chandler, who goes around with a cynical eye. He knows all parts of society, has access to all parts of society as a detective, a private detective. Mm-hmm. And that's so he's engaging in the new information landscape. He's not inventing new technologies like Leonardo da Vinci, which is like a hardware inventor. He's engaged in pattern recognition, which is the more prominent activity of the software world of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's an interesting subplot that I discovered. I've been talking to Dennis Young, this art historian, art teacher, did a couple of dialogues with him, which I posted on Dupes. He pointed out to me the beginning of the artist as cultural hero in the romantic rebellious sense that kids worship now began with the painter Rubens versus the establishment, the Royal Academy that ran the salons. And Rubens was known as a sketcher, whereas the established names, who none we remember now, we don't remember those famous guys of the day, the successful people. Just like in 100 years, they won't remember Oprah Winfrey, but they'll know all about Bob Dobbs, you know. But
of course,
Oprah is queen in her day and the moment.